Hello?
Hi there. Scott here.
Hi. All right. Let's see. All right, so we have Marion and Scott. And who else?
This is Jane.
We have Scott, Jane, and somebody else?
Sarah.
Okay. People saying their names. Okay. Right. People's words are getting chopped off here. I have Marion, Scott, Jane, and Elizabeth.
Margaret's here from Madison.
Was that Don?
Yep.
No, Frank.
Okay, Frank. Don, are you on also?
I am.
Okay. Good.
Sarah Maisie is here, too.
All right. Well, the other thing I'm going to do now is I am going to shut down these entrance chimes. Okay. So we won't hear people coming in, but we won't be interrupted either. All right. I'm going to try again. I'm going to list the names I've written down. Marion, Scott, Jane, Elizabeth, Margaret, Don, and Frank.
Are these the people on the call? This is Marta. I just joined.
Okay. Yep. This is people on the call.
Hi.
Who else?
Maisie.
Who was that? You have to speak up.
Sarah Maisie.
Oh, hi, Sarah.
Hi. Sorry, I was on speaker. It wasn't working well.
Okay. So we'll start with, are there any announcements of any kind that people would like to let everybody know about or get input on?
Well, this is Margaret Madison, and I'd like to find out if anyone else on the call is going to be in D.C. next week for a roundtable on communicating climate change adaptation. I'm going to be there, and I actually don't know anyone else who's going to go. So, wonder
if
anyone else is going.
I'm not going to that meeting. I'm going to the NSDLL projects meeting next week in D.C. So what is this Communicating Climate Change Adaptation?
Yes, it's a round table, and it's Tuesday afternoon? Tuesday and Wednesday.
Oh, okay. Well, is this the one that CEQ is holding?
White House.
I mean, I'm sorry.
Environmental quality?
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. No, I don't know anything about it. I tried to find out about it, but I know nothing about it.
You don't need to find out. I just want to know who's going. So.
Well, but that's the key thing, is this thing just kind of slipped out of nowhere.
Yeah, so how did you find out about it, Margaret?
I got invited to it. They called me. They called me 2 days before the report was released, which was a progress report of the Interagency Climate Change Adaptation Task Force. They called me on Tuesday. They released it on Thursday. And that was about 2 weeks ago. And to date, I don't know anyone who's going. So I thought I'd ask the climate literacy network.
So what is the group that that's running it?
The White House Council on Environmental Quality.
Yeah, I think this is the report that UCAR helped put together.
No, Mark, this is not that one. This is the Presidential Task Force on Adaptation.
Yeah, I think it's the same thing.
They're not. No, they're not the same thing. They're different.
Well, when the UCAR adaptation report came out, they had to get it approved by OSTP at the White House.
Right. That's the other side.
So, Margaret, if you can send us information, any kind of background information, that would be very helpful.
Yeah, I wouldn't mind having more. I just have my letter. my invitation letter. So.
Okay. Yes. Yeah, so, no. Yes. Would be helpful if we just understood what it was more. Some of us will be in D.C., but we'll be at the NSDL meeting. Which Frank, are you going to be going to the NSDL meeting?
I wasn't planning on it.
Okay.
Is it something I need to be at?
Well, I don't know that you need to. Why don't we look at the agenda and talk about that offline?
Sure,
I was just wondering because the project, a lot of members of the project are going to be there, so I just.
Yeah.
That. So we'll talk about that.
Wednesday mid-morning, we're going to be presenting a report on collection quality and gap analysis, the clean experience. So if you want to go, that would be a good time for you to be there.
Okay. And that's the Wednesday, the...
Yeah, the Shoreham Omni Hotel.
I think that's the third. The 3rd, November 3rd.
Yep.
Okay.
There also are a couple of other sessions that are coming out of the Clean Project. One is on the standards that Ted Willard is, and actually he sent me an email with questions that we want to ask that are, I could look those up. Actually, it would be a good idea to engage this community in identifying those questions, but I don't have them in front of me now. But just so everybody knows what we're talking about, the Clean Pathway Project, the Climate Literacy and Energy Awareness Network Pathway Project, is a National Science Digital Library funded project. And the all NSDL All Projects meeting is the first 3 days of next week, the 1st, 2nd, and 3rd. And so a group of us who are actually on the project are going to be attending that meeting, and that's what we're talking about.
Clearly I've not been tracking it. So if you can send me any information about the all NSDL projects meeting or where I can find the agenda, that would be helpful.
Okay, so I'll send that out. So, Margaret, we weren't really able to help you. You probably have more information on your meeting than anybody else does.
Right. I'm just curious if anyone else is going, partly. So,
okay.
Well, thank you. I'll report out afterwards.
All right. Any other announcements? Okay. Well, if not, we will move on to the agenda for today. A number of us were at the NRC Climate Change Education Roundtable meeting last week in D.C. We kind of went over the agenda last week, and I thought this week we could give a debrief to everybody as to what actually happened there. So let's see. I was there, and Frank was there, and who else on the call? Don was there.
I was at the meeting.
Oh, Elizabeth was there. That's right.
And this is
Caroline Lewis.
This is
and
Jane,
Caroline was
I
there.
I tried to be there from a distance, but that was somewhat of a failure.
Yeah. Was it difficult the second day also?
I'm sorry, I wasn't able to try and tune in the second
okay.
day.
The first
morning
day,
and
the
afternoon of the first day were poor.
Yeah, I understood that, but I had no way of getting any. I got all of your messages once I got back to my hotel room, and I did talk
right.
to them the next morning, and they said they did change the way that the audio was being done, but I had no way of knowing whether it actually worked or not.
Mm.
So,
and
anyway.
And I haven't heard
well,
further, so I don't know.
I know Karen, Scott, did you try to call in the second day? I know you were trying to call in the first day. No, well, I can't hear Scott. Okay, well, anyway, we'll go on. So for those of you that did participate remotely, if you do have any comments or, questions certainly along the way, the way that this meeting was structured, it was, just for some background, the first meeting of the roundtable was last May, and that was more of a getting-to-know-you meeting in which basically all audiences were open for discussion and all mechanisms were open for discussion, and as a result, it was such a huge topic. I think a lot of us went away a little frustrated that we really didn't come to any conclusions even as to how to move forward. The members of the National Research Council kind of took the input from that, which was basically a lot of notes that people sent them, and developed this workshop agenda for this time, which I think worked really well. They narrowed the focus in not to say that we won't eventually talk about these other audiences, but the audiences that were discussed or considered at this meeting were the public and decision makers. And then they had three major questions or issues that they put before the panel and before the roundtable, which this time was not only the members of the roundtable, but there was a much larger presence from the broader community there. physically in the room. And so there was generally a panel with some speakers that spoke directly to the topic from their particular perspective, and then a discussion. And then we broke into smaller groups of about 20 to 25 each, and address specifics around those questions. And I think the agenda from the meeting was posted on our telecon site, so you can see that if you want to pull it up from last time. But the first question that we addressed was the goals of climate change education across these particular audiences, and then we had a series of questions to answer in these smaller groups about these issues. And I don't know that the first round we were to identify particular audiences and the goals of those particular audiences. And then the second, so that was like the morning session, and then we had report outs from those groups. Then we had the next major question for the afternoon was mapping current public climate change goals and outcomes to various audiences. So again, we were Tony Leiserwitz talked about his most recent study, which was around public understanding of climate change, which is a little bit different from the Six Americas reports, which is more about attitudes and belief that climate change is happening. But this particular study was about what people really do know about climate change. And then there was a series of panelists there that again gave gave brief discussions about that topic from their own perspectives. If anybody wants to add at this point, I can go on to the next one just to sort of give an overview of the whole thing, and then we can talk about the specific impressions that each of us who were there got from the meeting. So should I pause here if anybody wants to make any comments?
No, go ahead. Finish framing it. I like this. It's reminding me of everything.
I like the framework.
Okay. So then the last, I'm trying to pull up the last set of discussions. Say that again?
Audience segmentation.
Right, audience. So the last one was implications of audience segmentation for education strategies and research. And again, we had a wide range of panelists, which I have here on my agenda bracketed off as thinking about them as potential Climate Literacy Network speakers. Each person on this panel talked about engaging particular audiences, very particular audiences, and even those audiences that could politically be naysayers, but addressing them and how to address and showing them how addressing these issues would be to their benefit, regardless of whether or not they think climate change is happening. So, and there were, I think, like six different talks from very different organizations and groups. There was one person from the Ohio Interfaith Power and Light talking about the faith groups. There was another person, I think this was Kevin Quayle, he was talking about engaging hunters and anglers in this kind of issue, because actually changes in the environment really do affect what they feel passionate about. So, but there were six of those talks, and I actually think that it would be really good to have some of them lead one of our discussions. And then again, we broke into groups and tried to strategize around those issues, engaging various communities in what might be the goals and how to engage them. And again, there were report outs, and there will be a summary report, which we'll certainly share with everybody and probably have a discussion about later on when it comes out, that the members of the actual employees of the National Research Council who are facilitating this roundtable will put together. So that was a general structure of the meeting. It really did seek to have engagement from a very broad perspective, but focused around particular issues. One of the major things that I think that might seem obvious, but really came out clear, is that no matter which group you engaged with, having somebody who was already in as part of that group, being the trusted source which brings these issues and promotes action on these issues to that particular community is the most effective and powerful. So that, for example, there are climate scientists who are members of faith groups, and having somebody who's in a particular faith group who is a climate scientist, they're going to be the most trusted source of information rather than somebody really from outside doesn't really work real well. But it was really just pointed out again over and over again. I think that was the most powerful message I got overall from a lot of the discussions. That and that there's a lot of groups to consider, but we already knew that up front. So I invite everybody else who was there, Don and Frank and Caroline and Elizabeth, and I'm not sure if there's anybody else who was there or participated on the phone effectively, to give their perspectives on that meeting. Anybody want to go first?
The hardest message I got was the need for coordinated strategies across the different populations we're trying to target, and which is everybody. And the complexity of that task. There are approaches that work for audience X while turning off audience Y, and trying to grapple with that complexity and come up with an actual functioning strategy is the big ticket item, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
So other than that, I'd say, you know, which you talked about some, but that was, for me, the biggest take-home lesson.
Mm-hmm.
Well, this is Caroline, and I would agree with everything just said. It was a little bit frustrating for me because it was so exploratory and less prescriptive than I was hoping it would be, and I think it had to happen that way, though, because we're trying to meet people where they are, and you have to vary your strategies, if not the message, when you do that. And I just came away with a sense of hope that they were reaching some audiences in those change agent identification and mobilization kind of ways. Like when I heard they had hunters and anglers in their fatigues and their guns, these are non-college degreed people, typically, and NRA-type folks. And when they were lobbying the government on climate change, I was very hopeful that if that could happen and the religious institutions could get some of these people thinking, it resonated with me. The one person that I felt provoked me the most was probably Aaron McWright. And he's from... Hello? He's from Michigan State University. And I don't know if you remember him, but he was the one who's had all of this experience with climate change, characteristics of climate change deniers. And his work was very informed, and it seemed to speak to Tony's presentation of public understanding and the Six Americas. And he kind of identified the biggest gaps as political or, you know, liberal versus conservative. And he since followed up with me with quite a few documents that informs his talks. And I'd like to share that with the group. But I think he would be a fascinating presenter for this group.
Mm-hmm.
Because he went through some, you know, long-term data analysis of Gallup polls as what are the characteristics of these climate deniers, and then everything else made sense from there, because if they're in that group, we have to have people who speak their language speak to them rather than the experts, right?
Well, you know, in that line, there was a poll released recently about climate change and Tea Party members. Has anybody else on the call seen this?
No.
No.
There was a New York Times article about that.
Yeah, and if you listen to what they're saying about why they say this can't exist, it has nothing to do with scientific information. It is most of what they're talking about there is, you know, somebody is quoted in that article to say, you know, God would not have put fossil fuels where they put them if they didn't want us to burn them.
Correct.
That's the kind of thinking we're dealing with, and and their trusted sources are, you know, Limbaugh and Fox and stuff like that, and they just, you know, accept it. It's very dogmatic, and there was some interesting conversations about dogmatic approaches versus, you know, non-dogmatic approaches. And sometimes dogmatic approaches is the most effective, but you get a dogmatic approach, and you know, it's a very interesting conversation. There's ton of really interesting conversations, but Don, I would echo your conclusion. And unfortunately, there isn't anybody funding us to coordinate all these disparate activities. And one of the things to remember is in the 90s, EPA had a series of programs in their climate change, global change division, that the whole point was to focus on influential audiences and engage them with very customized strategies and build relationships for years and years and years, and then when the next administration came, that was completely dismantled. And, you know, so it seems like it took us a long time to find out that this approach was something that existed before, and, you know, here we are 2 years into the next administration, and we still haven't reassembled that strategy in any robust way. So we are not nimble.
I'm just wondering if there's a way with the CSEP grantees, if there might be a way to kind of link onto them with a more coordinated kind of strategy.
Well, what we're trying to do is, I should have said this up at the beginning. I have invited, and Elizabeth, you're an example of this. I invited all of the CSEP projects and the new NASA GCCE projects, and I do need to get the email out to the NOAA Environmental Literacy Projects to join the Climate Literacy Network and to post their project descriptions on the Climate Literacy Network site. And what I'm hoping is that through this mechanism of the Climate Literacy Network, we can help facilitate some of that coordination. So, because I agree that the CSEPs are a great example of a concise group that is funded to try to coordinate efforts.
Right.
There's just one thing about the one Achilles heel on the CSEP grant is that they are principally strategic planning grants for the first 2 years.
Yeah, I know.
The second phase is, the second phase is a major issue that NSF is going to have to struggle with to fund. It's a slow strategy, is what I'm trying to emphasize.
Yeah, well, it's a slow strategy, but I think that how we've worked, even through the Climate Literacy Network thus far, is having these conversations across lots of very different groups that are represented on this phone call and on our listserv, to have engagement and buy-in at these very early stages. I don't really expect them to be involved at a very high level to begin with, but if they participate in conversations and those areas that are relevant to them, they engage with more, that's the kind of buy-in that we need up front, rather than having them go and develop their infrastructure and then, oh, by the way, now we're going to coordinate. I think having the buy-in early is what might help. And I've suggested to these projects that they could potentially get input from the Climate Literacy Network to move their efforts forward and present at one of our calls and sort of engage in that way, so that the Climate Literacy Network could support their efforts even at the strategic planning stage. So I don't expect a whole lot of engagement, but beginning the conversation, like you said, we'll get buy-in early.
I was just saying, I think it's worth the effort.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, this is Elizabeth. I'm very excited to hear more about the Climate Literacy Network. And my colleague Jim Bray and I just joined this. We have a NASA GCCE that was just funded on a large scale. And one thing we're really hoping to do is provide a number of local and regional linkages to our teachers across the country that are taking our climate course. And I'm really excited about the resources that are on the website. And also, one thing I learned at the NRC workshop last week was just how many programs are out there.
Uh-huh.
There were ones that I just hadn't even, you know, thought about or heard about before, and they're programs that would be perfect linkages with some of the K-12 teachers that are also doing similar outreach activities.
So, Elizabeth, you want to just give us like a 3-5 sentence description of what your project is?
Sure. Yeah, our project is called DataStream Earth Climate System, and some of you may be familiar with our DataStream Atmosphere and Ocean courses that have operated for quite a number of years. And we have teams of teachers and scientists across the country. There are about 25 teams that recruit 8 local teachers a semester and then administer a full course to them, and we provide all the materials. And one very important part of what they do is they create a plan of action for local community outreach and also outreach within their school district. And we're really hoping to link our teachers with, you know, other efforts that are local and regional in terms of these outreach efforts.
Excellent.
Great. Thanks.
Well, so this is Caroline. I just want to add something, Tamara, that on a bigger picture, a little bit away from the science, in my breakout sessions, there was some comfortable tension. It wasn't upsetting by any means, but there was definite tension between an NSF all or nothing approach. It has to be deep science, beginning to end, wrapped up in a little bow package where, you know, everybody declares that, to casting wider nets and really trying to engage people where they are, even if it's not a full-blown hands-on investigation. And I was very pleased to see NOAA really advocating for more of that, and NSF sort of battling, well, it's not a good model, and it's not this. And it's really about this divided America and the social lens that people view everything, and media selectivity now is such that you don't have to hear what you don't want to hear. And that came across very loudly from the speakers and the panelists, that, you know, knowledge alone will not change behavior. Media selectivity is keeping people in their bunkers and silos even more than ever. But that they do self-identify, if not as NRA or conservative, their moms or their dads or their something. And the more we can look at social change as happening where they are and finding the means to start the conversation, the better. And I think I kind of came away with the fact that we're doing a lot on the science end and trying to get teachers and change agents and students and so on to embrace the facts and the knowledge and the reading of graphs and charts. But on the other hand, the whole conversation that's happening at the interfaith level and the hunter and angler level and the other is kind of the stuff that I think they wanted to attend to more at this conference, but you know, we kept going back to formal education over and over again because it's such an important entry point. That was just my take on
at least in my group, again, you know, we each have the perspective or the breakout group that we actually happen to be in. In mine, well, there was one, at one point we were having a discussion about these faith-based group, and as many of you know, in the Clean Pathway Project, one of the major pieces is review of materials before we actually advocate for any particular resource to be used. And so when we were talking about, well, somebody, a scientist within a faith-based group who put together a presentation for their group, and I sort of asked about review, and she kind of looked at me like,
I know, it's like a free-for-all.
Don't think that that would, I don't think that would work real well. And I do understand it, but there's this tension there of who do you trust. And what my idea was, all right, so this person used the resource in her group, and could possibly it be used in another Episcopal church someplace? Well, yes, but will they trust it if it hasn't been reviewed? And or is it just a matter of that it has to really come from somebody within their own group? Is it inherently something that can't easily be shared? And it was not a question I had, because in the formal and informal education context, that's not an issue. Everything really does need to be reviewed, and everybody kind of accepts that. But when I, and this is from a person who's a scientist who's used to that, but in the context of the religious group, it was, she looked at me like, I don't think that will work. So that's a, you know, that's kind of an interesting, maybe it's these interfaith groups that span churches and even denominations and religions can address that a little bit more effectively. I mean, maybe we have the person who gave that talk, and I forget his name now, but I can pull it up.
Yeah.
He was
pretty good.
Greg Hitchinson. We could ask him that question, because he was one of the panelists who talked about addressing this issue across religions and denominations. But I didn't really, that was before we had this discussion about review.
I think it's a good question.
This is Marta, and I always feel like I'm a newcomer, and so please forgive me if I'm, well, I am a newcomer. I'm not a scientist, I'm an arts person, so please forgive me if I'm saying something that's not appropriate. But in a way, this reminds me a little bit of in the 80s, the beginning discussions of multiculturalism and the importance of bringing people of color onto a board or a staff that was all white people, in the sense that I think it seems like all of us are, to a greater or lesser degree, of the same mind in terms of climate change. And, you know, would it be possible to bring people in from a faith group or, you know, of these different constituencies to help us think about how we might reach those very constituencies in ways that they would understand?
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? Because I feel like we're also convinced of the right way. sort of like this friend of mine who was a counselor for when my husband and I were having trouble getting along, as we sat down, she said, "So, do you want to be right or do you want to have a relationship?" And I feel like you know,
I want both.
Yeah, right, exactly. And I just feel like it would be so great to have those perspectives that are not us yet in our discussions, to be able to understand how we're not communicating as well as we might be.
Mm-hmm.
And, or like, for example, I mean, we're working on a project now in Indianapolis where I've been instructed, and this is bringing together artists and scientists and sustainabilists and all kinds of folks, to focus on the White River. And it's in doing that, I mean, I've been told by, we have multiple partners from the Indianapolis Museum of Art, to the zoo, to the State Museum, to the city, all kinds of folks. And I've been told that we can't use the term climate change in Indiana. You know? So it's like, oh, okay, let's see. How are we going to work with this one? So, and of course I do every time I possibly can. However, but you know, how do you couch it? And so what we're doing is we're looking at the White River and how that's important to everybody. And so that brings in all these other different kinds of groups. And it's not like we have all the answers and we're making mistakes all as we go, but we're also kind of negotiating into what's important to people and helping them understand how climate change fits into that discussion.
Right. Well, it seemed to me from this meeting that you didn't even really get to the point of having to say and how climate change fits into it. If you look at the White River and all of the different groups that are impacted by that environment, and then it just addressed the changes in the White River or the environment around it that impact them, you do never have to say the word climate change.
You don't have to, but you could. Right.
You could. But if it's something that's going to turn them away and not trust you.
No, right, exactly. But yeah, I hear what you're saying. Yes, absolutely. Yep.
I mean, that
there
was the message I got. Go ahead.
There is a wonderful resource out there that was written a long time ago, was revised at least once, called Getting to Yes. And it's about getting away from just identifying the position that you know that is right and going toward what are the things really people really value and care about. And then it allows you to get away from the knee-jerk response to just the word climate change and get to what people can actually do. I forget who sent around the energy change that happened out in Kansas, the article from the New York Times that was sent around.
Yes,
I think I sent that.
Funded.
That was great, and I think that speaks exactly to this level of conversation.
Do you want to just summarize for everybody that's on the phone what that article was about so everybody has context?
Okay, the person who sent out around, are you on?
Yes,
Don.
Don.
And in short, it's a community in Kansas taking steps to reduce their carbon footprint without ever talking about the fact that it's taking steps to reduce their carbon footprint, but doing talking about energy and independence and autonomy and being fairly successful. They said it was a 5% reduction in carbon emissions, which is really substantial. It's considered that a 1.5% reduction is considered to be successful, and these folks were doing it without really thinking about global warming, but for all the other reasons that one thinks about it. That's the short version.
Now, I mean, it sort of speaks to me. The person who talked about working with the anglers and hunters, that was the one I think that struck me the most in terms of just addressing what is important to that particular community, irregardless of the bigger picture. And I think I think that applies to lots of different groups.
But it was also hopeful that if you can't meet them at that hunter-angler level, there's some other group they identify with, either their parents or their kids, you know. So I think that there are multiple access points for the target audience. We just have to explore them and know how to speak within them or identify the change agents within them to ground in the right science. So I kind of came away that, okay, I come from a Republican family, I'm sorry to admit, and I have watched the turning of the tide ever so slowly because enough of my siblings respect me and where I'm coming from that they will listen. And I know not to push the abortion button and a few other things that are their hot spots, but I do see that if you can't get them in the group you think they identify with, there's another group they identify with. And a lot of people as parents do want to leave the world a little better for future generations or something else. And I do think that the whole point of knowledge alone does not change behavior. And if climate change education and climate change literacy, if one of the ultimate goals is behavior change, then people like Marta, who are using the arts as this entry point, as this vehicle to tweak attitude and emotion, we have to give them more support and a platform from which to launch in conjunction with science. Yeah. I think at the end, did you remember Tamara and Don and Elizabeth when he was saying that we have to start including the social sciences more and the philosophers, and I think they're trying to really see. The term social movement came up in our group but was quickly squashed because people didn't feel that a social movement on climate change would be a good thing to articulate. It could happen, but they didn't want to spare or head it or drive it, which I thought was interesting.
Now, I don't know. My sense actually was that as people began to suggest other groups that we should be engaging, I think that it was a... I kind of sense a welcoming of that concept, that idea concept of really opening it up to these broader groups. And I think that they did that to some extent at this meeting with some of the panelists who were actually engaging these groups and trying to, as you said earlier, meet them where they are.
Well, there's a paper that I want to find. They quoted it, the Moody paper on Do Scientists Understand the Public? And I think that is a question that everybody on the phone here wants to bridge. We want to make sure that the scientists can tell their stories in a meaningful way or find the agents that can so that it's not just you know, you looked around the room of an incredible group of people coming together to be very thoughtful and to explore pathways to climate literacy. And it was white. It was an all-white educated audience, and that's not middle America. And we were all like going, yeah, we're really good at talking to each other, but how are we at you know, reaching these masses that aren't necessarily reading what we want them to read or even reading anything?
Yeah, no, it was striking. It was pointed out that it was mostly a white audience.
Mm-hmm.
So this is Mark, and maybe I can chime in. Actually, last week, while the roundtable was going on, I was on a panel discussion at NCAR, National Center for Atmospheric Research here in Boulder, on communicating climate change, and Chris Mooney, who was just mentioned, was on the panel with me, along with Naomi Oakes, who's the provost at San Diego State, or some of the San Diego University colleges, like Scripps and so forth. And it was very interesting. I was honored to be there, and of course, wove the flag of climate literacy, but a lot of what we're discussing today was discussed there, and I think to NCAR's credit, from the leadership of Greg Holland, who's a very interesting Australian character, they're looking at what they can do institutionally to do a better job, you know, particularly around formal institutional communications, but also the outreach and the, because obviously a lot of the scientists there do outreach and or get called up by the press, and some of them were caught up in the Climategate scandal and so forth. And then NCAR also has a pretty strong educational program as well. So there's a lot cooking and a lot of parallel discussions going on in different groups about exactly these same issues of how do we frame things, how do we target our audiences, how do we know what they really need or are interested in, and the trusted messengers, all these ideas seem to be really taking hold in the broader climate science community. So that's good to see. You know, and I totally agree with Marta's points, and I also feel really strongly that there is a role for literacy and good knowledge, even though information alone is not enough, but in order to make good, solid decisions, we need good evidence and understanding of the urgency and the risk factors and so forth. Of course, all that gets filtered through people's different agendas or priorities or ideologies, but we just need to become much, much more strategic in how we communicate. So one question about the workshop that I have, and likewise for the roundtable, Margaret, that you're going to next week, is there any kind of summary document that's coming out that will help us, that those of us who are not going to be able to attend, to stay plugged in?
Yeah, well, the roundtable will put together a summary of the outcomes of the meeting. They also commissioned some papers for this meeting, which I can probably share. I think I received them all by email. And so some of them are still draft stages, but some of the speakers put together basically an overview, and I can share those also.
Yeah, that'd be great. I'd love to see that.
And was the NRC, was that taped, audio taped or videotaped, or on a web?
Yes.
Yeah,
I think it was recorded. Because I remember them asking people to actually go to the microphone so that it could be recorded more effectively.
Correct.
Yeah. David Blockstein said that he thought that it would all be archived and put up on the web at some point.
So how would I, this is Marta, how would I track that? How would I...
There is a public site for the roundtable, and I will find that URL and share it with the listserv.
Thanks so much.
So Frank, you hadn't really weighed in too much on your perspectives of the roundtable. What were your so you want to address that a bit?
I guess the thing that frustrates me the most about all of this is it doesn't look like all of what we talked about is going to be rapidly deployed, learned, and used. We're talking about, you know, generating reports that may inform our decisions in some period of months. And the thing that's just utterly frustrating in all of this is that that's how we've been working. And just does not seem to be a path to success within the time frames that we have. I mean, I was on one of the panels, and somebody said, you know, we talked about a lot of what isn't working. And then, you know, somebody said, well, what is? And, you know, a lot of very interesting strategies, techniques, programs that we've even talked about today have been, you know, highlighted and have some evidence that they are working. I mean, the idea of influentials, we've talked about this a great deal in this call. And yet, after this call, very little of that lesson that could be learned and implemented will be learned and implemented by those out there who have that ability to do that work. And I'm not, I'm feeling very pessimistic here, but what I'm getting at is that, you know, a lot of us, I think all of us, have day jobs, and that day job is fully occupying us. So, I mean, part of why I was so quiet in the second half of the workshop was because I was pondering, well, exactly how are we going to take these wonderful things and implement them at the scale that is being asked of us? And, I came up scratching my head a lot. And that's where we are.
Yeah, I agree to some extent, Frank. And so things are slow, but I think that what we have here in the Climate Literacy Network is an ability to share it more actively, more broadly. And so what I'd like to do is invite some of these people that actually have examples of what's working.
Mm-hmm.
Give talks on here so that we can sort of begin to think through how each of us might implement. And I don't think we can ask people to do lots of extra things, but if they can learn from what these other people have been doing that are effective and integrate it into their own work in this area, that might, and again, it might still be too slow, it might be slower than you'd like, but
it'll help us move
forward.
Yeah, no, moving forward is absolutely the case. I mean, you know, there is no status quo. That's unacceptable. I'm not feeling 100% today because I think I caught the bug that was going around in all these meeting rooms.
Oh, no.
All that. That's why I'm on the other end of the phone. But that all said, I agree. I agree, Tamara, absolutely. And I mean, you know, we continue to move forward in a very progressive, action way as opposed to just talking about it as an academic. But all that said, I still think that, there's a lot of us in this community who are, the normal modes of getting grants and using those grants they're a weak tool. And I think, you know, one of the things I heard in the conversations was we were looking for much more powerful tools, much more effective tools, and really struggling together. I mean, that's a lot of very good things. But still, at the end of the day, I think a lot of us need to be striking out for that more powerful strategy here of, you know, how do we bring ourselves together to, you know, have this be our job, not our extra job. And I'm still, you know, as you all know, I've been struggling with that for years. So it's still there. So it was a great meeting, but at the end of the day, it was still just a meeting.
Mm-hmm. That's true. But it did, I think that the outcomes and this, my sense afterwards was it was better than the first one. I had a deep sense of frustration at the end of the first one that while there's still some frustration now, I thought we had much more meaningful discussions at this one that might get us someplace. compared to the first
Frank,
one. Was a lot
better. I kind of completely agree with you, but I was more hopeful at the end of this because I do think the last breakout session when we were tasked with how do we scale up these things or which ones are scalable or what do we do was probably the most heartening one for me because I am action-oriented and I do want to take the conversation into action. And I think that at least asking the right questions now, and I hate just mulling things over for too long. At some point, we got to pick the gems and run. Mm-hmm. But I did get a sense of hope, at least in my breakout session, that was where NSF, NOAA, and a few of the government entities wanted to go with the non-government entities that were in the room with me. So
I would agree.
Your people at NOAA were probably the more open-minded of the government groups, I thought, in terms of really wanting to cast wide nets and understanding the true diversity of Middle America, whatever that means, you know.
Well, you gotta remember we've got weather service people and extension people who are the salt of the earth, you know, people. They're very different, and they have a different modality. They're trusted in communities, and they have these kind of conversations where they're just, you know, you're just like me. It's a different kind of conversation that I think we need to have.
Is there, this is Marta, is there a way to come up with some core working principles that everybody could be sort of simplistic, but just a checklist, say, that you just would always ask yourself every time you put together a program or a talk or a, you know, and not to make it too cumbersome, but I'm just thinking about, you know, just of this idea of a different kind of diversity of opinions and expressions and the people who don't want to use the word climate change, you know, is just even to have something that you're always striving to make sure that you have people of different opinions informing whatever it is that you're doing. I don't know. I'm just thinking about is there something internally that would be really simple that would just cause this, you know, a light bulb or a shift or whatever, just the fact that logic alone is not enough. There always has to be cognition as well as affect in whatever happens.
Yeah, well, I don't know whether there's something that would be just be simple, because one of the things, another aspect, well, an aspect that came out over and over again is each group has its own unique, perspective and its own way of thinking, and you need to kind of address them, as we said before, where they are. I think figuring out a way of crossing groups, because one of the things that was pointed out is that any individual person can belong to multiple groups, and so one avenue into one group may be through another group. But in terms of working principles, I don't. Maybe if you kind of drafted what you really had in mind, it's hard for me to see how one set of checklists would help in all cases, because it would be a different set of things to think about for different kinds of audiences, is what I'm worried about.
Yeah, no, what I'm thinking about is just, for example, think, what I like to say is, you know, think ecosystemically, meaning, and I talked about this a little bit in my presentation, you know, there are lions and there are bears and they're all different kinds of species of people, sort of metaphorically speaking.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that if we just are, you know, we're a core species here on this call, so to speak. But there's a ton of other folks out there that we've been talking about today. And if we think ecosystemically, just as what you're saying, really, I guess that's what I'm trying to reinforce, is that they're all different kinds of folks out there. That would, to me, be a principle. Because I think a lot of times we shoot ourselves out of a cannon assuming that there's only one species. And that everybody should understand, because, you know, and then we just speak louder.
Instead
of, well, you know, okay, go ahead.
No, that's all I was just going to say. That, you know, for me, that would be a principle.
Mm-hmm.
But this is Caroline, and I have to check out. I have another conference call now. But, you know, so I'm predominantly an educator who takes on, like, broad scale, casting wide nets, hoping that everybody gets touched and then some get a very deep immersion into the topic. And I came away with some tremendous ideas on everything from having a workshop for scientists as storytellers, having teachers as translators, and students as ambassadors. And I'm going to try and get the local community college to do a TED Talks, TEDx Talks, with all of these people then around environmental issues. I also came away with Mythbusters. As again, I find much more success with getting people to find out what they know and don't know rather than telling them. And so a whole exercise in having teenagers create Mythbusters bookmarks for me, and then, you know, we sort of choose the best or whatever else, and a million other visioning scenarios. And one of the best things that I came away with, because is somebody said, why don't you envision 20 years from now, 50 years from now, 100 years from now, the best case scenario for what the news headlines would be and what some of the lead stories would be. And then do the same for the worst-case scenarios. And I think that's a visioning exercise I could use with any audience I am addressing or helping somebody address, because I think it sort of puts the ball in their court. And so I came away with a lot of strategies of empowering people who aren't empowered to think about some of these issues, and I'd like to share more of that another time, but got to run.
Of course, the problem with that is Thanks. People go, what's a newspaper?
No, I have a lot of success with giving these kids these platforms, and sometimes they're wrong as hell, but, you know, the only way you know what they don't know is by finding out what they think they know, you know?
Right.
So, anyway, sorry, but I got to run. Bye.
Okay, bye. So we only have a few minutes left. Are there any other comments, perspectives, questions about the roundtable or anything else?
A comment that comes to mind is that I don't often get to drop the title of my dissertation, but I've been rolling around in my head a lot during this conversation, and that title is Scientists Are from Mars, Educators Are from Venus, Relationships in the Ecosystem of Science Teacher Education.
That's great. I want it. This is Marta.
Yeah, I wish the dissertation was as good as the title. But I've been thinking about some of it for a long, long time of trying to get different.
Are you going to post that for us?
Send it out to the listserv, Don. Just say, this was requested during the call today.
No, you can just give it to us, and you can make it an exclusive thing that we're the only people that were on the call.
Yeah, I can post a link to it, I think. So I have been talking about this kind of thing for a long time, because it's dated 2000.
Yeah, well, you see, the thing is you were just dealing with these two communities when I think that we've gone, like, the number of communities has exploded.
Right, right. And that's actually the after the colon part is the relationships in the ecosystem, and
mm-hmm.
that gets into the some of the problems of that model of just the two being involved in teacher education, when it's really a whole lot
mm-hmm.
more than that, is
yeah.
through developing public understanding of anything. Really anybody's understanding of everything. There's a whole lot of
yeah.
factors input.
Yeah. Actually, the other thing that we probably should announce, a number of us on the call are going to be, just before the NSDL meeting, there's going to be a meeting to begin to formalize energy literacy principles. We sort of did that with a small group in a draft way in the Clean Pathway Project, but that's going to start to be addressed in a much more robust and way with a larger community next week also. So just so everybody's aware of that. Okay, so. If that's it, we're to the end of our hour, and so I'm going to be at the NSDL meeting next week, so we will have our call. Maybe Scott, if you're still on the phone, maybe you can facilitate the call next week.
Sure. Yeah.
Okay, great. Okay, so there'll be a call next week, and we'll talk to you soon.
Thanks, everybody. This is Martha. I was
thank
here.
You.
I was,
thank All right, you. Thank you. Thank you. Bye.
Thanks, everyone.